This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Humans have used psychedelic substances in a variety of ways for a long, long time. Indigenous communities incorporated plant-based psychedelics like ayahuasca or psilocybin into religious or medicinal practices for hundreds, even thousands of years. In the 1960s, LSD and mushrooms, alongside marijuana, played a prominent part in the counterculture movement. And lately, more and more people in the United States are getting interested in possible health benefits of microdosing psychedelics. Everyone from people seeking help with medical conditions to Silicon Valley professionals wanting to improve their focus at work. Just to be clear, psychedelic drugs remain illegal at the federal level, but there's growing momentum to talk about changing that, including here in Michigan. Last September, the city of Ann Arbor decriminalized psychedelic plants and fungi, and one organization that worked on that effort is now hoping to decriminalize them statewide. As psychedelic use continues to become more commonplace, some entrepreneurs are building careers out of educating and even coaching people on the practice of microdosing. West Michigander Paul Austin is the founder of The Third Wave. It's an online resource for folks who are interested in learning more about psychedelic use and microdosing. He's also the author of Microdosing Psychedelics, A Practical Guide, and he joins us now. Paul Austin, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, April.
Paul, what do you think our society's perception of psychedelics is at this moment in the culture?
It's an emerging tool that can be very useful for healing an array of mental health challenges or issues or conditions that have proved to be previously intractable for the vast majority of people. Depression is now one of the leading causes of disability worldwide. Something like 300 million people have major depressive disorder that has undoubtedly gone up in the last year with COVID. And it looks as if psychedelics are catalytic in their healing potential. And instead of numbing us to, you know, what has caused us suffering or what has caused us pain, like many conventional psychiatric medications do, psychedelics actually open up a space in which we can face with courage what has previously proved to be difficult to accept and use it as a therapeutic tool to help with healing things like depression, alcoholism, end-of-life anxiety, PTSD, OCD, the list goes on and on. So I would say this is becoming more and more widely accepted. My mom, for example, works at Zeeland Community Hospital in West Michigan. She's a social worker. It's part of Spectrum Health. And she started receiving emails about conferences from her work that are related to ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And so that, to me, says that within 3 to 5 years, this will be really a mainstream part of our medical model. And it, I think, will be part of an evolutionary next 10 years in which we'll see radical changes throughout society as a result of many of the things that we're now going through with COVID-19.
At the same time, there are a lot of people who may have never had any experience with psychedelics or who might have had, shall we say, a non-therapeutic experience with psychedelics that did not go as planned, who understand dosing more in the sense of overdosing or dosing incorrectly. Can you explain a little bit about how microdosing has gained some momentum as a therapeutic treatment?
So the inventor of LSD, Albert Hofmann, who invented LSD in 1938 and had the first ever LSD experience in 1943, towards the end of his life, talked about how he often used microdoses of LSD as sort of a euphorant or as something that was just helping with, you know, cognitive ability. And he lived to be 102. He was a very healthy man till the end of his life. And so this sort of got out into the space and, you know, word got to a man named James Fadiman, who's a psychologist, got his undergrad at Harvard, first took psilocybin in Paris with Ram Dass, who was Richard Alpert at the time in the early 60s, and then went on to pioneer early stages of psychedelic research. And Mr. Fadiman is now, you know, in his 80s and has really been a pioneer in the psychedelic space from the second wave through the third wave. And so in 2011, he published a book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, which is really a phenomenal manual on the art of responsible psychedelic use. And one of the chapters in that book was a chapter on microdosing, where he essentially surveyed his community, asked them to try out this thing where they would take low doses of psychedelics, about a tenth of a regular dose, two times a week for 5 weeks, and see how it went for them. And the sort of anecdotal results that he collected were really interesting. You know, writers would talk about how much easier it was to be articulate in what they wanted to say. And, you know, career professionals talked about how it really helped with sort of alertness and, you know, a positive mood at work. You know, other folks talked about how it helped them with certain mental health conditions for low mood or depression. So these were beautifully well-written reports, and they then basically informed for the next decade, 2011 until now, an incredible interest of research in this, because the predominant form of research around psychedelic substances was in high dose clinical settings, largely in the 1950s and 1960s. There were thousands of clinical papers published on psychedelics, but unfortunately, because of the way that it sort of got out of control in the wider culture, there was a backlash. Essentially, people say we weren't quite ready for this now or at that point, but it was an opening, it was an awakening. And now a lot of those ideas that were birthed in the 50s and 60s from widespread psychedelic use that had been counterculture are now increasingly becoming sort of our mainstream culture. And I think that is an exciting and optimistic development for a lot of folks who, you know, have been on SSRI medications or ADHD medications or other conventional psychiatric medications. And it's just unsatisfying. It helps sometimes, but usually the efficacy goes away. There can often be negative side effects, and they're quite addictive. They're very difficult to get off of, to wean off of. And microdosing psychedelics provide, I think, an opening to work with a substance that is healthier, that's better for you, that is anti-addictive, that helps with addictions. It's anti-inflammatory, helps to lower chronic inflammation in the body, which is very useful for healing, for depression. There's elements of neuroplasticity to it, et cetera, et cetera.
Paul, can I ask a question about process?
Sure.
In places that have started rethinking the regulation of psychedelics, one of the things that comes up early is the question of coaching or facilitators, people who can help folks who are interested in this as a therapeutic use. And I know that Third Wave offers a microdosing coaching package. That's one of the things that you do. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important to have a coach or someone in the mix and an outside perspective to help people with this?
Yeah, it's really the role of a guide, a caregiver, a healer. You know, it could be a curandero, it could be a therapist, a psychiatrist, right? They come in many forms and names, but ultimately their goal is to provide a mirror, is to help guide someone into a deeper knowing in themselves, to become more coherent, to heal certain trauma that might be stored in the unconscious and the subconscious, and to do it in a way that guides someone to better outcomes, to more flow, to more creativity, to a better sense of presence, awareness, purpose, you know, more cognitive clarity, a number of benefits. And so having a coach, having a guide, someone who's sort of walked that path before you and understands how to work with these substances, because as you've mentioned, these substances, they're becoming widely destigmatized in many ways, and yet there are still a lot of misunderstandings about them. And so I think one of those is that although these are illegal, that they are useful and powerful tools, right? There's a reason they are illegal. There's a reason they've largely been used more in the underground historically for thousands and thousands of years. There's something very threatening about widespread awareness in some ways. And this is how psychedelics have always been. So I think knowing someone who knows how to work with those powerful tools, who can help guide someone, who can be there for them. And sometimes that's clinical, you know, if it's a more therapeutic, you know, therapist, psychiatrist, counselor, clinical psychologist role, it's therapeutic. But more and more, and this has been my particular focus, it's on optimal outcomes. It's really looking at how can microdosing help with leadership development? How can it help with optimal well-being, with things like flow and creativity? And what does it say about people as they're starting to work with psychedelics in terms of both microdoses and also higher doses? How does that change the work that they choose to pursue even? And a lot of people are finding that they want to focus on things that are more about purpose, about giving back, about, you know, being in community. I see a lot of overlap between those who are working with psychedelics intentionally with a coach, with a guide, with a therapist, and choosing to pursue more fulfilling, aligned paths in life.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Paul Austin, a native of West Michigan, who's also the author of Microdosing Psychedelics, a Practical Guide. Paul, how were you first drawn to the microdosing experience?
So when I was 19, I did mushrooms with friends. And then about 5 months later, I did LSD in the woods on a beautiful May day. This was like last day of the school year. I went to Hope College, so everyone's drinking kegs and, you know, having a fun party with alcohol. And it's like, it's a party, but we were like, it's a really nice day. What if like five of us just took acid and went out to the beach? So we did that and it was stunning, beautiful, amazing, profound. And I had for a period afterwards, this afterglow effect where, you know, I felt a little more centered, a little like, oh, I want to meditate more often, eating healthier, cleaner, just making generally better decisions, being more connected in relationships and friendships, less on my phone, you know, less in front of a computer. And I noticed this relationship between psychedelics and sort of growth, development, expansion, freedom. And then I started microdosing about 5 years later, where I had those early opening experiences with high doses of psychedelics, beautiful afterglow effect. And then I'm building my first business, online coaching business to help people learn English and pass standardized tests for English, and sort of microdosing to help with more flow and creativity, and also just help to, you know, let go of some social anxiety. I stopped drinking for the most part alcohol and just started to microdose with small amounts of psychedelics instead.
How do you describe the difference between the recreational experience and the therapeutic experience?
So the therapeutic experience, I would say, is oftentimes much more personal. It's about you. It's about your healing process. It's about going deep into you and, you know, clearing out the cobwebs. That's the more therapeutic experience. Now, the therapeutic experience can still be done in groups. So both are done in groups, both therapeutic and recreational can be. But the therapeutic is much more zen. It's much more keep to yourself, quiet time. Recreational, I would consider to be more like, you know, you're looking to go for a beautiful 3-hour hike somewhere with a close friend or your partner, and you decide to take a microdose of mushrooms or even a higher dose. And, you know, you plan a day and you bring a playlist and you bring a little food and water and you go out for a beautiful day together. So that I would consider to be recreational, but still incredibly therapeutic and healing and beautiful and profound in its own way. And the recreational I find to be more about interrelational connections, like connecting with other people and using these medicines as ways to bond and understand one another and connect with one another.
You know, since this is an entirely new area in terms of places in the U.S. loosening regulations, you know, there's some people who have safety concerns about what's going on. What's on your mind about the kind of training that coaches and facilitators and guides should have?
So they need to be trained in how to listen. They need to be trained in how to empathize, trained in how to work with these substances in higher doses, microdoses, also things like breath work. You know, they should have some training and understanding of things like yoga or diet. You know, it's a really integrative practice. And more than anything, a willingness to love and be open and to hold space for someone who's going through a very, very difficult experience. Now, depending on the need of the patient, so if they are a clinical patient, if they have depression or PTSD, you know, a psychiatrist, a therapist, someone who's clinically trained is going to be ideal for those types of people. And I would say that's about 20% of folks. But for the 80%, you know, basically the other 80%, it doesn't necessarily need to be a clinical professional. It can be someone who is a good friend. It could be someone who, you know, who's a great listener, who's done a lot of coaching, potentially certifications, who has an active practice themselves. And that's a growing network of practitioners, you know, who are not necessarily focused on the clinical side of things, but they're focused on non-clinical outcome. They're focused on leadership and flow and creativity, these elements of positive psychology of growth and expansion. Because oftentimes the initial process with psychedelics is healing, right? There's often for many, or if not all of us, elements to explore of the shadow, elements to explore what needs to be healed, what needs to be, you know, come up from the subconscious and the unconscious. But for those of us who have either done this or had other practices, these are phenomenal tools for like these expanded states of being, which are just so connected, so beautiful. They feel very artistic. There's an incredible aesthetic to them. It's really these, you know, heartwarming, beautiful experiences. And that's always been my orientation. And then, you know, how do we take those experiences that just fill us with so much bliss and joy and profound gratitude for this experience, that we carry that energy through into other elements and areas of our lives, you know, the work that we do, the relationships that we hold, right? We hold ourselves to a really high standard of awareness, mm-hmm. in a way. And that to me is what I find to be fascinating about the coaches element. So coaches, facilitators, absolutely necessary. And depending on the needs of the patient who's being guided, sometimes clinical, sometimes more towards creativity, leadership, flow, optimal well-being.
Have you ever run across someone who maybe you felt wouldn't benefit from this? Like, have you ever had to say to someone, this might not be a good fit for you, or you had to steer them elsewhere?
Yeah. So as one of the first project I started, Third Wave, which is an online platform, which you had mentioned before, I also started a retreat center in the Netherlands called Synthesis, because psilocybin truffles are legal in the Netherlands. I spoke at a couple conferences in Europe, met a Dutch co-founder, and we opened a beautiful place. And we kept it specifically on non-clinical, because neither of us had clinical backgrounds as the co-founders. We hired and brought in early on a therapist and a medical doctor to be there, but we also, anyone who applied, we knew had a medical condition or was on certain medications, we screened out and had to say no to. Now that's changing for them now. They've built out a clinical team. We brought on investment. You know, it's like that's been necessary. And that's what's so important about doing this. It's really understanding what are your limits, to what depth can you hold people? And at that point in time, we both said, you know, what we want to start can be purely wellness oriented. We're not prepared yet for the clinical side of things, because there's a lot more challenge and difficulty in that. There's a lot more messiness in it. There needs to be a lot more care and attention. On a more broader base, people who are predisposed to schizophrenia or other personality disorders. And I have friends who have healed schizophrenia through psychedelic use, and it is also very risky unless you're working with someone who has done it themselves before or who is trained in it. So more often, psychedelics are used for rigidity and sort of a tightening of the default mode network, and that rigidity is more associated with depression, addiction, these sorts of things. The people who are already open, who have already seen through the veil, so to say, like someone who might identify with a schizoid condition, they're better off not using psychedelics. And then there's also other small little things. There's a great company that just got up and going that's doing psychedelic genetic test kits. That's called Halugen. And Halugen, you can buy a test kit from them, and then it'll do a genetic test to see, is it okay if you work with psychedelics? Or do you have something that means you shouldn't, like some sort of gene? And they can now test that. So I think that's a great starting resource for a lot of the people who want to do this, but I want to make sure it's safe and, you know, they don't have any sort of underlying condition, because I think that will be a lot more people, especially in non-clinical settings. It will become very easy fairly soon to simply grow your own mushrooms at home. And we're already seeing widespread decriminalization, not only of psilocybin mushrooms, but of all drugs. And I think that will only accelerate in the next 10 years.
Paul Austin, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
You're welcome. Thank you, April.